Case number 22-5074, IT Cert Alliance, Inc., Appellant versus United States Department of Homeland Security. Mr. Forney for the appellant, Mr. Press for the appellant.
Morning.
Morning. Thank you, Judge Katz. It's may it please the court, Jeffrey Forney for appellant, IT Cert Alliance, Inc. Please like to reserve.
Try to talk in the mic. I'm not hearing it very well.
IT Serv's members have suffered and continue to suffer increased operational costs due to the rule USCIS announced in a matter of Simeo, which the agency imposed prospectively, without exception, on all H-1B employers through a policy memo issued contemporaneously with that proceeding. However, the rule in Simeo was not the product of an adjudication. Rather, the agency wants to characterize it as such, but the proceeding was not an adjudication. It doesn't have any of the typical features of an adjudication. Rather, it sounds as a legislative rule. The agency has imposed it on the regulated community as such.
The agency had before it the question whether Simeo solutions had improperly failed to get the second, apply for the second visa, the amended visa.
Thank you for the question. The characterization may require some qualification. It wasn't a visa that was at issue in that case. Your Honor is correct that the proceedings leading up to the appeal before the AAO did involve the foreign national appearing at a consulate for a visa interview, but that wasn't the crux of the matter.
I may have the immigration terms wrong, and I apologize for that, but if I do, but I'm just making the point, the dispute came up in the context of what we would call a case or controversy if it were in an Article III court. Wasn't just the agency musing in the abstract. They had an actual dispute before them, and they had to resolve it. And in the course of resolving it, they had to construe this language in the agency regulation about what it means, what the phrase material changes means. Seems about as adjudicatory as you can get.
Well, the administrative record suggests otherwise.
Suggests what?
Suggests otherwise. The government produced in the administrative record a rather interesting letter that was issued to Simeo, who is the putative party in the case. That letter indicated that around 2011, the employer had already asked that its petition be withdrawn. And under the regulation, that request resulted in an automatic revocation.
But is there evidence that, I understand that letter, is there any evidence that Simeo withdrew that letter not just before the appeals office ruled, but also before the director of the California service issued its letter? In other words, is there any evidence it was withdrawn before that decision?
Well, all we have is the administrative record, and Appendix 70, that letter in which I referenced, indicates that a letter of withdrawal or revocation was ordered on September 23, 2011. Therefore, the approval of your petition is automatic.
Was that before or after the original decision?
Well, the letter of withdrawal or revocation was ordered well before the decision issued in the AAO.
Before the appeals decision.
Yeah.
But doesn't it have to have been ordered before the original decision?
I couldn't hear you.
Doesn't it have to have been withdrawn? Your point is that the withdrawal of that made this not an adjudication, correct?
Yes.
There's no evidence that it was withdrawn before the original decision.
Which original decision are we talking about?
By the office's decision.
Administrative Appeals Office decision?
No, before that.
Now, there were only two decisions at issue in this case. The first was the approval of the petition. Well, then there was a revocation by the agency. And then there was the AAO proceeding that resulted in the published order by the AAO. This letter indicates, at least with the dates that we see here, that the petition was automatically revoked well before the AAO proceeding. Of course, by definition, it would have been automatically revoked after the original petition was approved. But that's what the revocation
was. Wouldn't the agency need to know about the revocation at the time it issued its opinion for this to matter? And there's nothing
sorry,
in the
I'm
record.
Having trouble hearing you.
Oh, sorry. Wouldn't the agency need to know that the petition was revoked at the time they issued their opinion? And there's no evidence in the record that they knew that. We can only review what's in the record before the agency.
Well, the letter in the administrative record, which the agency produced as part of this record of proceedings, contains this letter of automatic revocation.
I'm just saying it's not clear the AAO knew about it, because it's not in the record that the AAO was considering.
Well, it is. The AAO actually produced this record. It was certified by an official of the administrative appeals office. It's in their record.
Okay. So I actually have a different question for you, and that's about the case Conference Group, LLC, and how it applies to this case. And Conference Group held that in a situation such as this, you have standing to contest the rule to the extent it's a rule, but you do not have standing to contest the adjudication. And I'm interested in how that applies in this case, because it strikes me that if you want to challenge something as granular as a letter that allegedly withdrew the petition, that seems to me to be an attack on the adjudication and not the rule. The rule is the general principle that when you move your H-1B recipient to a different location, you have to amend your petition before the agency. But these sort of granular case-by-case things, such as this beneficiary lived in Long Beach, but he was working in LA, the petition was dismissed in the middle of this appeal, that seems to me to be a challenge to the adjudication and not the rule. And Conference Group suggests that you can't challenge the adjudication.
Yes, I appreciate the question. I think some of the confusion that revolves around this issue maybe is the way in which the district court judge viewed that. And I think Your Honor is sort of reiterating that position. And it's understandable, but the critical point is that we're not challenging any particular aspect of the putative adjudication, including the letter at issue that we've been discussing. That we're not challenging that. That letter is merely indicative of the fact, among other points, that this is not an adjudication because of what happened in the proceeding. Its characteristics, including the characteristics tied to that letter, show that it was prospective only, in effect, had no direct bearing on the putative party in the case because their petition that was supposedly at issue is no longer live. The AAO, therefore, was addressing an abstract issue. That kind of characterization, at least according to this court's precedent, brings it over to the rulemaking side of the paradigm.
So you're saying that, I'm just trying to understand the distinction between challenging an aspect of the adjudication, which is that the petition was dismissed, and not doing that, but instead using it as evidence of that this is a rulemaking.
Yes, precisely. Because the rule, an adjudication has two characteristics. Case-by-case, fact-sensitive, in which the agency addresses those facts and during the course of the proceeding may come up with a principle.
I understand all that. But basically, the Simeo record is not actually before us. You were not a party to the Simeo proceedings. You are just trying to challenge the precedential effect of the ultimate holding of the Simeo ruling, which is what you think is a legislative rule. But to do that, you are getting into the details of that Simeo proceeding. And it strikes me as procedurally strange that you should get to do that.
Well, and this goes back to, I think, Your Honor's point about Conference Group, which, as I believe you correctly pointed out, suggests that a non-party to the case can't challenge the adjudicative aspect of an order that appears to affect. Of course, there's a couple of material points of distinction there. One is that, of course, the court found that case there was an adjudication. We're contending here that this is not an adjudication. Its characteristics, among other things, the characteristics that appear in the administrative record show that it was a rulemaking on adjudication. The second more critical point is that the party in the case challenging the rule in the conference room, the court noted that they would have actually had the opportunity to challenge the application of that rule or precedent that the agency formulated in a separate administrative proceeding to distinguish that case and show that they did not fall within the ambit of that precedent rule. That's not the case here. There's no procedure by which any member of ITSERV can do that. Therefore,
I'm curious about that. Why not? When you apply for that, can't you say
right.
It's our position that if this person moves, we shouldn't have to
repetition?
There's no vehicle to do that?
There's no vehicle to do that, certainly not in the manner in which was noted in a conference group, which the FCC, of course, had more elaborate procedure in that case where the Bureau might review your practices, and then you can challenge whether or not your practices require you to pay into a fund. And then you can appeal that to the FCC before you incur any financial losses by being held to pay into a fund. That type of proceeding isn't available.
I want to ask you about, so that was one way you distinguished conference group. But there's another way you distinguish conference group that I want to ask you about. You say in your brief that the plaintiffs here failed to show that the challenged action and this is a quote from your brief, would have a pending certain harm, and that unlike here. But in conference group, the court, we were very clear there that the adjudication that the plaintiff was challenging there had found that companies like petitioner, you know, a particular type of telecommunication services, would have to contribute to the Universal Service Fund. They found that our case was based on that. And that sounds just like this case. You know, there they did show some harm, namely they had to contribute to the Universal Services Fund. Right, they had to pay into the fund, and there was no question about this. And your client has to pay more for these petitions, and I don't see why they're different. If it wasn't enough in the conference group, why is it enough here?
So I understand the conference group, one of the critical points was that, again, I think there's two critical points. One is that it was unclear that a non-party to that case was actually required to pay into the universal. Into that fund. The only order at issue was that the conference group and related parties who were subject to the FCC's order were compelled to pay into the fund because the order is directed
right.
to them. The order wasn't directed to any other party, and moreover, more critically, separate parties could actually challenge in the future whether the FCC was going to apply.
No, I know that argument. I get your argument about that. I was just asking about this, what seems to be a separate argument in your brief that unlike here in conference group, they had failed to show any impending harm. And it looks to me like they did, that they would have to pay into the universal services.
Oh, well, if your honor is indicating that the parties in the conference group did show an imminent harm, is that?
Yes.
Yeah, I misunderstood the question. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, you said in your brief that they didn't. That's why I asked you the question.
Right. I mean, I think the case stood on the principle that they couldn't show impending harm because the order didn't apply to them.
And they could show what?
Because the order did not apply to the parties in the judicial proceeding. I mean, that's different here. We have a different situation here because the policy memo that was issued contemporaneously.
And your whole distinction of conference group turns on your argument that there's no other remedy here for your client, right? There's no other way to challenge it other than through this
That's true.
That's your distinction for conference.
That's the primary distinction.
Yeah.
So I'd like to come back to that because I think it's important. But it seems to me that you could challenge this in one of your client's proceedings because one of your, I don't know, members could apply for the H-1B visa, get it. Their person could move. They could get the LCA but not petition. And when they try to deport that person, you could raise all the issues that you're saying now, that that is not appropriate. Your substantive arguments, such as now you're intruding into the Department of Labor's area. So you could challenge all of this. It wouldn't be pleasant for the H-1B visa person who's the beneficiary, but you could challenge this within one of your own visa applications.
Well, I'm sorry, this gets into some technical nuance about immigration. I apologize about that, but your Honor mentioned challenging that type of issue in a removal proceeding. The employer can't be a party to a removal proceeding that is specific to a foreign national where the Immigration and Customs Enforcement alleges.
How did Semeo bring it?
Well, the foreign national issue in that case was outside the United States at the time. He had gone to a consulate to get a visa. Initially, he was working for Semeo.
I'm just trying to understand how Semeo brought that, because you're telling me that none of your members could bring the case before the AAO.
Well, because there's no way to ventilate this issue before the agency, before the harm is actually suffered. In other words, the agency laid down a global rule of general applicability that applies to the members and says, if you're going to move folks, file the LCA, but then you have to file an amended petition, full stop. And associated with that amended petition is the court's filing fee and other transactional costs. So you incur that harm before you can go to the agency and say, hey, we don't think this applies to us. There's just no procedural mechanism to raise that issue.
Can't you move for declaratory relief like in TIVA?
The agency, to my understanding, has no procedure to petition for a declaratory relief. I mean, the FCC has a regulation, for example, which, of course, this court knows well about because it's
For a preliminary injunction? It just seems to me that it's not clear to me that you don't have a way of raising this issue other than attacking Semeo.
Well, there's no way of raising the issue before the agency, before the harm is incurred.
Why can't you move for a preliminary injunction?
Well, of course, that would require civil action, which is exactly what we did.
Right. So why can't you do that? Why is you resorting to?
So we did file civil action. Of course, the district court below dismissed on various grounds. So that's what we tried to do.
No, but you brought a civil action attacking Semeo. I'm saying, why not in one of your members' own cases? Can't you litigate this?
Because there's no way for the issue to be triggered before they actually comply with the rule in Semeo. And then when they comply with it, there's no way to actually go to and file a civil action and say, hey, we want
to... You would have to not comply, right? You would have to not comply and then move for a declaratory judgment or a preliminary injunction or let it proceed where your beneficiary gets deported and then you approve. But it's just not clear to me that you cannot litigate. Well, there's no way to litigate.
Right, but in conference group, there was an administrative proceeding to ventilate that issue before any actual harm. What Your Honor is suggesting is to flout the rule that USCIS put forward in Semeo, wait for an enforcement act.
That's what conference group would have had to do too. If somebody wanted to challenge this in their own case, they would have had to probably flout the conference group rule and then litigate it.
Well, right, but it would have been ventilated through the Bureau, had delegated authority to hear the issue, and the party could have raised the points before the Bureau and then had an administrative appeal before the FCC. That type of proceeding is an event.
But I just don't understand why Semeo could do it and none of your members can.
Semeo could do it because they were actually the named party in the case, but of course, they weren't anywhere to, they didn't actually appear in the appeal. So let's be clear about that.
But I'm just saying that issue was brought to the AAO. Semeo brought that issue to the AAO, and you're saying it's impossible for any of your members to do so.
technically submit. Simeo did not bring the issue before the AAO. It was certified by the district director. So Simeo did not appeal. It was certified, of course, after the petition had been revoked.
Okay. My point is simply Simeo brought that to the attention of a rulemaking adjudicatory body, and I don't understand why none of your...
Well, it didn't, because it didn't appear in the proceeding at the AAO. At least there's no indication in the administrative record that they appeared. But of course, if they chose to appear, that would be...
I guess my question is, Simeo happened. How?
Well, Simeo, I think is how you pronounce
it. Okay, Simeo.
So I apologize.
All right.
It happened because, of course, they were a party to the administrative proceeding. It was their petition. The revocation proceedings involved their petition, and the certification of the AAO involved their petition. So, of course, they were a party in that administrative proceeding. The whole point here is...
So then what happens? So they say their petition was found to be insufficient, and then it went to the AAO, right?
Well, it was certified to the AAO.
Certified to the AAO. And why can't that whole process happen with one of your members?
Because there's no way to bring up that issue before compliance. And if you fail to comply, then what happens is, as indicated in the agency's policy memo, you can be sanctioned by the employer, and the employer or a national is out of status and put into removal proceedings. Those removal proceedings are not a vehicle by which the employer can challenge any of these issues. Immigration judges don't have jurisdiction.
Thank you. I understand.
Can I just briefly on the merits ask you this rule or adjudication question? It's obviously significant for standing, but assuming we get over that hurdle, on the merits, you want to call this a rule in order to argue that the agency failed to comply with notice and comment rulemaking.
Right.
And your main reason for saying that is that they changed their mind on how to interpret material changes in the regulation. And that would have been a winning argument under our decision in paralyzed veterans, but that was unanimously reversed by the Supreme Court. So, even if this is a rule, it's obviously interpretive. So your notice and comment claim doesn't get off the ground either way.
Well, I agree with you if we were talking about the agency changing course through the same proceeding. I believe it was mortgage bankers where the Supreme Court took
right.
issue with the paralyzed veteran, Alaska professional hunters, I think, the original case. But that's not an issue here. We're not raising the point about the agency, changing course in the same proceeding. Of course, it is a different type of proceeding, but that's largely irrelevant for our argument. The argument is you have a statutory provision which doesn't address the issue, doesn't mention it. Agency publishes a regulation with a broad, open texture term like material change that changes with the facts and circumstances of the case. There's no way to flush out the meaning of that term except through further legislative rulemaking. If you flush out the meaning of that rule, you're necessarily putting flesh on it in a material way that would require rulemaking. That's
okay.
What the agency did in matter of Simeon, and that's what we're finding to be procedural.
Okay. Judge Tatel.
No.
Judge Pan. No,
thank you. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honors. Joshua Press from the Department of Justice is here on behalf of the Department of Homeland Security. Judge Pan, I want to get right to your question about, seems sort of critical here. Is there a procedure by which one of ITServe's member companies could challenge Senate? The answer is absolutely yes. And it is, this type of situation happens very frequently. In fact, today, there are numerous H-1B visa petitions with applicants in India who left during the COVID-19 pandemic. They are waiting sometimes very long periods of time, but they are waiting with very old LCAs, very old H-1B petitions that were previously approved by USCIS, and they're waiting for a consular interview. And the reason I bring that up is the exact same fact pattern that occurred in Syria would occur with those H-1B visa applicants. They would be beneficiaries. Be clear, the companies that are sponsoring them are the applicants themselves, per se, but the beneficiaries are the ones who have to go for the interview. And it was in that precise factual context where the consular officer from the State Department, which Castle was pointing out, makes a determination as to whether to issue the visa. Now, that is slightly different than, to be sure, what USCIS does and what the Administrative Appeals Office, the AAO, did in this case. But I think the critical point in why Simeo was necessary for USCIS and the AAO to actually adjudicate and issue a presidential decision on, that they were seeing this fact pattern again and again, where essentially sponsoring employers would try to game the system by including a lower wage area of the country. And then they would sort of use consultants and specialty occupation visa applicants to go to many different places across the country for 6 months or years instead of the actual wage rate that was initially determined, I think, within a 7-day period of time long ago by the Department of Labor. So when the consular officer sees the blatant mismatch between what a visa applicant is telling him or her, oh, I'm going to work in Hoboken. Hoboken, for better or worse, is not Long Beach, California. And that actually sort of raises a lot of suspicion with the consular officer. They might think, well, why are you lying to me? They might think, is this guy a security threat? And they have to do follow-up with that. So the follow-up in this case was,
sorry, you're talking about the initial.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Right? The follow-up in Simeo was, hey, you need to check out the initial application, the labor certification, the labor condition application that the Department of Labor approved as a prerequisite within 7 days. And to be clear, they're only looking for completeness and for obvious inaccuracies. So they're not going to catch if the work site gets substantially moved across the country.
This problem arises when an H-1B recipient comes into the country to work in wherever, Long Beach, and then is moved to Hoboken.
Yeah, it could easily arise in that because.
Is there any mechanism? What's the mechanism at that point for judicial review if I'm short of DHS notices the violation, the lack of a second filing, they deport the alien, the employer is not a party to the deportation proceeding, but then somehow once the alien has been removed from the country, that seems to be the posture in which Simeo came up. Is that the mechanism?
Right. Well, the normal mechanism would be if DHS or USCIS actually understands that the initial petition grant was made under false pretenses. Mm-hmm. They could revoke the petition, or they could issue a notice of intent to revoke, and they could flag for the employer who is the actual.
Sorry, DHS does that?
Yes.
Okay.
And they could flag, hey, we noticed that your Department of Labor condition application said Long Beach. It looks like the actual beneficiary is working a lot in Hoboken, which is.
Has a different.
$9,000 difference.
Prevailing
differential
wage.
In the average wage rate. I think for an applicant who is getting about $50,000 a year, it's a 20% difference. It's a big difference. You need to respond to us, or otherwise we're going to revoke the petition that was previously granted. That would leave them unable to employ the applicant. And the beneficiary would then be out of status if that status gets revoked. But that does not mean they might not be able to change status to something else. It also does not mean they're going to...
When DHS notices that violation and does what you're describing, is the action against the employee or the employer?
The employer. Now, the deportation proceedings or removal proceedings that are under the INA now, those
against
are
the employee.
Against the employee, the beneficiary, right. Individual applicant. But that, I want to be clear here, we're not talking about any sort of scenario here. Any of IT service members, employees today, if they're here on H-1B visas, who being threatened with deportation because ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is a separate sub-agency within DHS. They make that determination. And they have their own prosecutorial discretion, their priorities, and that's all under very different litigation from this one. But that's sort of I'm hoping to explain the procedural posture that DHS uses. I know it's very complex.
Can I just ask, so when the agency issues the notice of intent to revoke your petition, can you appeal that? Can
Absolutely.
You move for a stay of that? Can you?
Yes, you can move to reopen or reconsider, or the AAO could take that decision that, let's say, the director's office does revoke, which is we're under a slightly different factual background, but we're basically in the exact same posture, operatively. They could take that revocation. The AAO could do the exact same thing here.
They would have to actually revoke, though, to get to the AAO. The notice of the revocation would not be sufficient.
Actually, the AAO could take it on its own if it wanted to.
Okay, even before the actual revocation takes place?
Yes, that's very, very rare. Because, of course, they like to have something, actual development for them. But it could happen, I believe. But nonetheless, the proper way to challenge that, I think the core of what we're trying to argue in our briefing and what we argue below, prior to standing in conference group, the proper way to challenge that is to bring an action in district court challenging the revocation as arbitrary capricious in violation of the APA. They could talk about Simeo or however you call the company's name. Of course, they're not here to actually pronounce their name. There, as this is an improper application of that or that rule or the adjudicative rule that was laid down in that opinion by the AAO is ultra vires or something.
There's no specialized review scheme that would attach to that. The INA is just, of course, chock full of these things that tend to...
Not beyond the AAO. The AAO would be the limit for within DHS, and then it would be up to a plaintiff employer or employee.
You could go to district court through the APA without having some kind of channeling argument.
That's correct. And that happens. It's not uncommon for that exact scenario to occur.
Well, I was going to change the subject.
Go ahead.
Assume I think they have standing to raise their argument that this is a rulemaking in the guise of an adjudication. Okay? Just assume for a minute that that's what I think. What's your best argument that this is, in fact, an adjudication?
Well, it had immediate impact to Simeo Solutions in the sense that they could no longer employ that employee whom they actually had petitioned for. They ostensibly wanted to employ, and it, of course.
What about their argument that they had withdrawn the petition before that?
Frankly, I was also frustrated by the record in the sense that I didn't.
Yeah, me too. So, can you help us?
Well, there. I think in terms of reading the opinion from the AAO, it reads not as well as Your Honor's opinions here, of course, but I mean it is. In a judicial opinion in that mold, to be sure. And I just don't think anyone can claim otherwise. Now, in terms of adjudicative facts that were there, they were presented with a clear record, a problem that they were seeing. Now, it's not, it wasn't a general problem that you would normally see in a notice of rulemaking. It was actual circumstances of specific locations, specific wage rates in different metropolitan statistical areas, visa applicant with a consular interview. Those are, I don't know how to say it, real world facts, and they were applying what they saw as the INA and their regulations, i.e. law, to facts. And that's what we see in an adjudication, differentiation from rulemaking, which is policymaking via actually announcing a rule, having notice and comment, discussing, weighing benefits and costs.
Okay, so let me go on then to, so you also say that that they don't have standing to raise their other arguments, not just the argument that this is a rulemaking in disguise, but they can't raise their other arguments, and you rely on conference group for that, right?
Yes, there's a lot of discussion.
Yeah, so is conference group, I'm just curious, in conference group, that was a petition for review, whereas here, they file an APA action just like in TEVA.
Yeah.
Does that make a difference?
Well, I think the core of our standing argument is that frankly, they could never actually show a definite time that one of their members were subject to Simeo, other than once in the course of litigation, but they actually could never show anything beyond someday intention of filing other H-1B petitions.
Okay, well, suppose I think their declarations are adequate.
Okay,
what's the other argument?
I do think that if you apply Judge Silverman's opinion to the court conference.
If you do what?
I agree with what you're getting at is that the conference group does make this differentiation between it as an whether it's an adjudication that's being reviewed or as a rule being reviewed, and the same sort of scenario could support standing for one, but not another. That is, if it were a rule, they would have.
No, let's assume I agree with you that it's an adjudication.
Okay. I don't think they would have standing because then they're a mere bystander, then Judge Scalia pointed out. It would be the same thing as someone coming in.
And what do you do with TEVA?
Well, I think within TEVA, the contrast is that they were actually pointing to a date certain. And we never presented with any date certain other than, well, we might file 63 more of these within that.
Well, but they have affidavits telling us exactly how much this is costing them and how many applications they're going to have to pay for in the next year or two.
Yes, but I think that's my point. It's projecting 63 within the next 3 years and projections of what it might cost is far from impending or certain or actual. And I think that's the distinction that we're trying to make between this case.
It's an awfully fine line. I mean, the affidavits are pretty clear, the declarations.
I respectfully disagree with that just because I would read those things as what might occur within 3 years, considering what we've all gone through in the last 3 years, as something intentions. And if something's coming up within the next 6 months and they could point to that.
Well, what else should they have said? What more should they have said?
I think they would actually say, we have this employee. We believe that he or she is going to need to be moved from X location to Y location with a different wage rate. And if we don't actually, if we're not able to do that, we're certain that USAS will revoke that petition.
But that's an argument about the imminence of the future injury. It's not an argument about, is this an adjudication or is this a rule?
Right.
And I thought that was the whole point of TEVA. I mean, you know, you have Scalia, but I have Tatel. Right. TEVA seemed pretty persuasive on that point, right? If you have a rule, if you have an adjudication, there might be reason for thinking like, who knows how it's going to apply in some future case. But that doesn't prevent a non-party to the adjudication from saying, look, it established a perfectly clear principle of law, whether we call it a rule or not, and it's going to have an imminent impact on me or my members.
So I agree with what you're saying there in terms of, and this is the distinction, same distinction in conference group, because there are two analyses of standing, two different distinctions. I just think that if you're going to talk about TEVA, the distinction was that they could actually point to it.
Was what?
Sorry?
I didn't hear what you said. If you're going to talk about TEVA,
Yes, relying on TEVA for standing purposes in this case, I think, is a vastly different circumstance because there was a date certain. There was a date certain. And so I think the Supreme Court case that came to mind imminently was Abbott Labs, where a pre-regulatory challenge of, we're sure that this regulation is going to go into effect on 5 months from now, and it will then cost us millions of dollars. That's a completely different separate situation from, well, we think we might file 63 petitions within the next 3 years. And if we had to do that, 63 times about $460. Sorry, I went to law school because I.
But it's really, again, maybe I'm repeating myself, but that's really a question not about rule versus adjudication. That's a question about whether this case falls within Lujan's intentions.
That's correct.
Point.
That's correct. Exactly. Okay. I agree.
The district court, though, found standing based on the business model of the member companies.
Is
that appropriate? It says the court finds, based on the member companies' business models, they face increased costs because of SMEO.
Yes, so we disagree with that. We respectfully disagree with that on that approach, because essentially any employer could say our business model requires us to shift people across the country. They still need to show imminent or impending injury, and that requires beyond more than someday. Frankly, we read the affidavits and never anything more than someday intentions, and that's why we.
Shadow.
No.
Okay, thank you.
We ask you affirm.
Thank you. Just 2 points. Your Honor, I guess I do need to correct a statement. I see your point. I've just reviewed a conference group again, and for standing purposes on challenging the rule, Your Honor is correct. The court noted that they actually did show additional financial costs because of the regulation. Nevertheless, later in the opinion, what hinged on the matter was that the conference group could go and before the Bureau and the FCC before they cost to the fund. That's just not available here. And on one of the points that my esteemed opposing counsel mentioned about those types of proceedings challenging an H-1B revocation is that the revocation actually has to be entered before an appeal to the AO is taken. But what the critical point here is that the employers in this regulatory regime suffer an immediate harm and consequence, unlike what was in the conference group, because what they do is risk not only revocation of their petition, but then the foreign national being out of status and removed. And therefore, if that happens, of course, they have no vehicle necessarily to challenge that revocation because they no longer have an employee here in the United States. The removal proceedings take place separately. They have no standing in that matter. And if the court doesn't have any other questions, I think that does.
Thank you. We appreciate the 8 seconds ceded back. The case is submitted.